and welcome to Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Abe. Aaron is away on vacation in the beautiful land of Japan, also known as the land of the rising sun. He might be making friends with Godzilla right now on the beach, having a little Mai Tai. Also with friend of the show, Terrence Johnson, joining them under a little beach umbrella. I've been seeing the photos. It looks fantastic and fun. Aaron will be back next week. We'll be having a full show. But today is a very special episode. Here's the agenda breakdown. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the film Obsession, which was released this past week. I have a little special segment with my friend who was gracious enough to send me a little bit of a snippet of her review for The Sheep Detectives. And then I have a very special guest, somebody that is near and dear to me, will be joining me later in this episode as they're moving toward a different phase of their education and curriculum. But first, let's talk about Obsession. Okay, I will note that we'll be talking fuller about Obsession in next week's episode as well. I would love to bounce some ideas off of Aaron, but let me read a little bit of a blurb here from IMDb. After breaking the mysterious One Wish Willow to win his crush's heart, a hopeless romantic finds himself getting exactly what he wished for, but soon discovers that some desires come with a dark, sinister price. This is a film by Curry Parker, who you might have known from his previous horror film Milk and Cereal, which was a viral hit. It stars Michael Johnston as a character named Bear, short for Baron, Indy Navarrete, who plays Nikki, the love interest in this movie. Cooper Tomlinson is Bear's best friend, and there's another character, Megan Lawless, who plays a character named Sarah. All four of these work over at a little music store in town. I found Obsession to be very, very good. Like, it's very effective in what it does. It's very thoughtful and dark and somewhat empathetic while still being mean to some regard as well. I really enjoyed the performances from everybody in this cast here, but certainly Indy Navarrete is having a standout section in this movie. Michael Johnson kind of plays like this sheepish character who goes on to have more to do in the movie in a very positive way. He sort of starts out as sort of like this quiet incel character, and I wasn't really sure if I liked him, and I honestly probably still don't like him by the end of this movie, but he has so much more to do. The actor is given much more to do. Same with Nikki. I think that Indy Navarrete's character has incredible amounts of physical things that they have to do, whether it be a twitch or whether it be a look or whether it be some sort of a chair movement or what have you. But I think that there's incredible stuff that is happening here, and she is playing it wonderfully. This film kind of centers around a lot of different themes of it's sort of like an adult Big, the Tom Hanks movie, where, you know, a wish happens, and some of these things have a sort of like a monkey's paw type of situation where things go awry with it. But I think what's particularly effective about it is that there is not a ton of sort of clarification of the mystery and how it came to be or what it is. Who's causing it. There's not really a ton of exposition about that. I think that you might have seen in some of the trailers that there is a scene where Bear calls a helpline on the back of the box of the One Wish Willow, and a lazy voice kind of answers and kind of asks him some things. That scene actually turns out to be one of the more striking scenes of this movie as well. So this movie is filled with surprises. Again, we'll talk a little bit more about it next week, but just know that I thought that it was very, very good. Okay, I want to pivot to a topic that we've touched upon but never fully expanded on in the past, which is YouTube and the power of YouTube, specifically around directors and those who have successfully transitioned into Hollywood film directors. For those who have been living in a cave for the past 25 years, YouTube is a streaming platform started by Chad Hurley, Stephen Chen, and Jawad Karim back in the early 2000s, right around the time that I was starting college. It took off like a rocket with viral videos and content creators. YouTube was acquired by Google in 2006. It began partnerships and monetization. The rest is history. But why is it important? Why would I want to spend time talking about it? Because it still serves as a place where people can explore videos and creators can still be raw in their work while continuing to work out incredible ideas or showcase a very polished library of their work. Love it or hate it, YouTube content has become a form of currency that has morphed and molded into the term influencer, and YouTube is a medium of entertainment that is here to stay. Those bold enough to make the leap from computer screen to the big screen have been few in comparison to the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of successful, relative term, YouTubers out there. Curry Barker is one of those people. He came onto the scene with his horror film Milk and Cereal, a found footage film about two roommates who are YouTubers and terrible things ensue. Curry is not particularly in a class of his own, per se. There are others that join him. David F. Sandberg, director of Lights Out. Dan Trachtenberg, director of the two most recent Predator films, Prey and Predator Badlands. Fellow film reviewer Chris Stuckman with Shelby Oaks, Markiplier with Iron Lung, and the Filippo brothers with Talk to Me and Bring Her Back all got their starts on YouTube. Sans Dan Trachtenberg, who made a sci-fi adaptation of the game Portal, this specific group all elected to make horror films. Now, horror is a genre that is often discussed with great care, love, and affection here on this very podcast. We even devote a whole month to horror movie topics. The genre is a historical one that has pushed boundaries, whether in theme and metaphor like in 1968's Night of the Living Dead, pushed special effects and gore like in John Carpenter's The Thing, or even pushed the limits of your own sanity with films like Japan's Pulse about the internet haunting your home. You can make it on a shoestring budget, run and gun style. You can shoot it with a camera in a locked position with noises creating an atmosphere for the viewer. The ease of getting the mechanics of a good, fun story down and adding in unhindered creativity from the ghosts, goblins, witches, demons, unhinged humans is all up to the creator. Financing for Hollywood films is notoriously tough and only grows tougher in today's market with what were once huge media conglomerates and titans falling by the wayside or merging to other studios with long hyphenated names. IP has become the name of the game, and remakes and retreads are incredibly hip and stylish in the moment. On top of that, there are a plethora of free and paid streaming websites with original content allowing you to live in the past with comfort films or seek out the next installment of a long-running series. Your choice, your time. And yet YouTube persists. It was once an untouched virgin land that was a hotbed of innovation. Original YouTube creators may be forgotten to time, but their impact and legacy pioneered what was possible today. I'm talking about Kev Jimba, Jenna Marbles, Ryan Higa, Wong Fu Productions, and I would be on the wrong side of history if I ever forgot Bo Burnham. This is just a handful of the OG pioneers. You see, back in the day, YouTube was unstructured clay. It was a platform that allowed anyone brave enough with a camera and idea to show it to the world. Naked, raw, honest, lightly edited, in-camera effects. Things went viral because they were funny and good and shared among friends that shared it to other friends, and so on and so forth. And that's how the coveted first 1 million views was achieved, and now we're in the billions of views. You used to be able to go onto the platform and discover a new voice with original point of view, doing incredibly dumb or incredibly incredible content on their channels. There wasn't an algorithm to chase. In a 2016 episode of Pete Holmes' podcast, You Made It Weird, Bo Burnham was talking to Pete about the 2016 YouTube landscape. Quote, "Look at the YouTube red billboards around town and tell me, this is the product of the most free distribution of content the world has ever seen. And that's the product. These bullshit, glossy, Instagram-filtered, Disney, pretty-haired, blue-eyed, perfect skin stars. What a failure. What a failure. YouTube's most subscribed and top people looking like studio-chosen stars. I thought in 2006, man, in 10 years, Oscar-nominated films would be on YouTube. And I was so wrong. And it's a shame. It's a shame." End quote. Bo certainly has strong opinions about YouTube. And my opinion is, he's right. We're in a sea of homogenous videos. Algorithms flood your For You pages and short sections with similarly thought out ideas. A new content creator with incredible skin and teeth on the page waiting for you to click and drive the money machine. And that's why Curry Barker, Dan Trachtenberg, David S. Sandberg, Mark Fishbach, Chris Stuckman, Danny and Michael Filippo, Bo Burnham are in a class of their own. They took the care and time to craft something that was bigger and beefier and more meaningful to them than normal videos. In the most effusively praiseworthiness of the term, they were artists trying to showcase their art. Sure, some of these folks still produced weekly videos, but how many of the other weekly video creators were writing in the off time trying to get a 90 plus minute movie off the ground? There are surely more creators that are out there trying to make their mark. This list can only grow from here, and that's incredibly exciting. Today's YouTube landscape looks incredibly different from where it started back in the early aughts. But it's always a delight and joy to see someone make the leap in successful ways. So kudos on your success of Obsession, Curry Barker. Congrats on making it past the waves of content creators and making Bo Burnham a little less jaded about the platform that he had held so much expectation for once in the past. And to all the creators out there who are looking for that one big break, keep writing, keep filming, keep editing, keep practicing. Believe in the power of YouTube beyond the clickbait bullshit content with zero calories. Okay, now on to our sheep detectives.
Sheep Detectives is a movie about a shepherd, played by Hugh Jackman and his stunning forearms, who dies unexpectedly and his sheep need to figure out who the murderer or murderers are. While younger children might not be able to understand the murder mystery mechanics, they'll still enjoy watching the adorable sheep discover clues and aid hapless humans while they create some chaos and skirt danger along the way. If that were it, The Sheep Detectives would have been a perfectly serviceable family movie, perhaps standing out for its absence of quick cuts and flashy colors that are otherwise so commonplace today in movies for younger audiences. What elevates the movie into something truly lovely, though, is the way it quietly shows viewers what bravery looks like when you're moving out of your comfort zone, and what it means to confront ideas you've always held but have never questioned. While doing this can be effortful or sometimes scary, it all feels achievable when you're enfolded in a community, or in this case, a flock, that might be full of characters who may not always act and think in ways that align with you, but who do their best to understand and care for you. This movie was written by Craig Mazin, best known for his TV series Chernobyl and The Last of Us, and includes wonderful voice and acting performances by a great ensemble. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Bryan Cranston, Chris O'Dowd, Sir Patrick Stewart, Emma Thompson, Nicholas Braun, and Hong Chau, just to name a few, and is in movie theaters now. Please seek it out. Watch it with kids, watch it by yourself. Either way, you'll walk away with no regrets and a reminder of the power of acceptance.
All right, now we're joined by a very special guest, somebody that I've known her whole life. I'd like to introduce to the show Riesling, my niece.
Yeah, hi. It's an honor to be on.
An honor? Wow.
Yeah, the highest esteem.
The highest esteem. Riesling, you are an up-and-coming college student. You are finishing up your senior year of high school. I've read some of your pieces that you've written for, whether it be a movie review and or just anything else. You're an extremely talented writer, but I wanted to get you on here because I know that you had some ideas and some thoughts about movies that you'd seen recently. For you being somebody that's like, you know, grown up in like the 2000s and sort of going to university now, I kind of want to talk to you about like the movies in general. Like how does your generation or you or your friend group feel about movies?
Well, personally, I'd say that definitely more on the cinephile side of things. I like movies. I love my Letterboxd. I'm addicted to Letterboxd.
Really?
Yes, Letterboxd is life. It's my like dream aspiration to be asked my top four, you know, with the Letterboxd microphone.
On a red carpet somewhere?
Yes, yes. But yeah, I really like movies. My friends, or at least one of my other friends, really also likes movies as well. But yeah, I definitely say that I'm more on that side, but
okay. As
opposed to my generation as a whole, I'd say we're more...
How do you feel that, yeah, how's the generation feel?
Yeah, casual moviegoers. I mean, it also doesn't help that.
What is
like,
casual, by the way? Is that defined as like one movie, two movies a year kind of thing? Or
Because
I imagine that you're probably watching movies like three or four times a month, maybe twice a month. So you're still more than the average moviegoer, probably.
Yeah, for sure. Last year, I managed to clock like an average of like 10 to 12 movies a month.
That's a lot of movies.
I mean, some of them were shorts, but like sometimes they were full movies. Yeah.
You certainly would be in the cinephile. I think like my number last year was like 100 something. My co-host Aaron's number was like 300 something. So he's like watching like a ton of movies. You're ripping through a lot too then.
Yeah, but I've kind of fallen off because I got busy this year.
Yeah. Understandable. You've got school life.
Yeah, but I just try to catch like the big ones. I try to catch those in theater.
You try to catch the big ones in theaters, like the new releases.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Are you going opening weekends?
Honestly, no. Like, yeah. I just try to catch them when I can.
Yep. Yeah. And then how are you hearing about like the older movies? Like, Also, what is old defined as to you?
Old, I'd say is anything like past the 2000s.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
Okay.
once you start getting into the 1900s, that's old. No offense.
So like the 90s is like an old time for you. I mean, it is also like 35 years ago. So no.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty old. That's like vintage at that point.
Wow. I mean, that is true. I can certainly see how if you did the math in the 90s minus 35, like you're kind of in the 60s there. So yeah. Well, when you're hearing about these, like, do you just is it the Letterboxd community that kind of like brings up a movie to you, or is it just your friends at school that might be talking about something, or are you just like reading the newspaper and you're just like, oh, they referenced Apocalypse Now, maybe I should go check it out?
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely a mix of all three of those things. And like I think that especially in this like digital age, you see a lot of recommendations online as well. Like my algorithm is pretty film centric.
Really?
And yeah, it recommends me some films that I should check out. Or also, if you're watching a film right now and I don't know, they reference older films or like older film techniques or whatever, you just kind of
Interesting.
want to check them out. I don't know. It's like a pipeline of sorts, like a never-ending expansion,
Yeah. Have you, what was like something old that you recently checked out? Old relative to me.
I think like a few months ago I checked out, let's see, let me consult my Letterboxd. Something older that I checked out was Days of Heaven. I actually pretty like Days of Heaven.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
I'm a proud uncle right now. Just I'm like, wow, I can't believe that your generation just sought this out on your own. Like Days of Heaven is like an incredible movie, like incredible
Yeah.
cinematography.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's my first Terrence Malick. I
Wow. I
gotta check out
mean,
more of his stuff, but
yeah, he
yeah.
goes on a run there for a while, like in the 2010s, where he's just like he's making a movie more than his average length, which is like 15 years apart or something like that. 10 years maybe, but still there's a run where he rolls off three or four. I'm curious like how you view those. But yeah, that's incredible. Wow, Days of Heaven. I mean, good on you.
Yeah, I
That
mean
just came up through your
like
algorithm?
I mean because I saw a reel on the director of photography Nestor Almendros and how he was like kind of losing his vision throughout the filming process and all that.
Wow.
And it was just interesting to check
Yeah.
out, so yeah.
Do you have any list of like favorite directors that you're kind of both, I guess, across all time, but I guess I want to segment it by saying, is there a director that you feel as though right now you're just like this guy or a gal has like the juice, and then even like in the more classic definition?
Ooh, has the juice.
Yeah, you're just like I will watch everything that they make.
Oh, I mean, I can't really think of, or I need to get more on my like up and coming director's grind, but I don't
Not at
know.
all. I mean,
Personally,
yeah.
I really like Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get through his entire filmography.
How are you watching his filmography? Are you watching it from like Rushmore on, or is it just at any given chance that you'll see it in one of his films?
Yeah, I'll just check out any one of his films, not in any
Nice.
particular order or anything.
Is there one that you kind of hold a special place in your heart so far?
Hard to say. I think the Darjeeling Limited.
Wow, yeah, that's one of his more quote unquote like underrated per se. I also love that movie. That opening sequence, fantastic.
Yeah, and like the soundtrack on that's great.
Yeah, there's a lot of Wes Anderson deals with a lot of like father figure type of storyline. So it's
Oh,
very
for sure. Yeah.
fascinating
Found
to see.
family, that type of thing.
Yeah, so just like when they're discarding all the luggage and then the music plays, like it's pretty incredible. So. Wow, Darjeeling Limited, very cool. Wes Anderson, also a big fan fave on the show here. Reason you've seen two movies recently that you want to chat about. The first one here is Project Hail Mary.
Yeah, I really liked it. I wasn't, I Okay, well, I did a little preparation. I read the book before I went to go see the movie because that's how I like to operate.
So you heard that it was becoming a movie, and then you're like, okay, let me go check out the source
Yeah, I think
material.
I th yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how it went. Yeah, I think they actually did a really good job adapting the book into the movie. And at the same time, I kind of wish that I didn't read the book before watching the movie. Just because, like, I don't know, to experience like the awe and the plot twist without the foreknowledge of what's to come is, I think, what makes the science fiction genre like really riveting. And like now, with the foreknowledge of the novel, I kind of knew everything that was like gonna come, you know.
Yeah. And they did have changes from the novel to the movie. Obviously, they can't do all like the science that the novel is doing. I've only read The Martian from Andy Weir, and I know that he's quite detailed when it comes to some like the physics and math that he will talk about in the book.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, 'cause part of the reason why I think that the adaptation of this movie was really good is 'cause like a lot of the sciencey stuff that they go on and on about in the book, like there are chapters one chapter just full of like I don't know, like relative time and all that stuff. The movie manages to compress that into a very like understandable and I guess like yeah, pretty understandable format. And I think Project Hail Mary kind of avoids that science fiction genre pitfall of over exposition. And it, I don't know,
You're
I feel
telling me that you
like,
don't like to hear about how a portal is created for 5 minutes?
yeah, not the biggest fan, I'll
Yeah,
say.
understandable, yeah.
But I think that they're really able to get the point across in like little to few words. I think, especially that beginning sequence of when you're like trying to figure out, oh, like what's going wrong with the Earth, you know? They're able to get across like, oh, the sun's dying in like very few words. They just had the news segment or whatever with the headline blaring across the screen, and it was pretty effective, I think.
Yeah, did they go through much more detail in the book about the planet, and was it like a few chapters long?
Yeah.
Okay. About like astrophage and kind of like how it's like
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
something's going wrong, we're losing. Did they go through like is it darker in the book? Just in terms of what might happen to humanity?
No,
Okay.
actually.
That's still like a
Yeah.
pretty like upbeat, we're trying to save the planet. Let's do this kind of thing.
Yeah, one of my main complaints about the novel actually was the fact that it felt very YA, like very young adult. Like, I don't know. I felt like the themes of like heroism and existentialism were just vaguely touched upon in a very surface level manner. But I think when I saw the film, it kind of, I don't know, this presentation of, I don't know, like extraterrestrial life and humanity, I think it more so inspires a sort of like punk rock hope that we kind of saw in last summer's Superman.
Okay, yeah. Punk rock hope. I like that.
Yeah.
Is that how your generation feels about things? Hopeful,
Definitely
but in a punk
not.
rock way. Okay.
Definitely not. So I think having these sort of films is, it's like a little pocket of happiness in the world.
Yeah,
As we know right now.
I'm glad that, as a youthful person, you're just like going into the world, really trying to drive some positivity and happiness and hope. I'll talk to you in 20 years. No, it's still very hopeful. It's still very great. I mean, we're getting movies like Project Hail Mary here. What did you think about, I guess, the you mentioned sort of sci-fi. Have you seen a lot of sci-fi films, and sort of where are you with that genre in particular?
I'm not the okay, well, I'm not the biggest sci-fi consumer, but at the same time, I do quite like Star Wars. Holds a special place in my heart, so can't say that I'm not a sci-fi consumer, but I feel like, I don't know, series like Star Wars or Dune, those are a different category of sci-fi, I'd say, and more like an emphasis on the fiction, I'd say. You know, where like they have to do this whole world building, they have to create a whole new universe, right? Whereas sci-fi, such as like Project Hail Mary, that's more grounded in reality and how we know it, you know? But yeah, I'm kind of fake because I haven't seen like the big sci-fi stuff like Interstellar or even The Martian or Arrival or any of that. So
Yeah, wow. Okay,
they're
so
on
you've
my
got some
watch
catching up to
list.
do. Yeah,
Yeah.
for sure. I'd be curious how some of those play out for you. I know that sort of like Interstellar's kind of taken a second life when it first came out in theaters. It was a hit. I don't think that there was enough of like a GIF culture and or like a snippet slash TikTok 60-second type of culture where they could just play the same scenes over and over again. So you're always seeing like Matthew McConaughey docking the ship or something like that, So, yeah, it certainly has gotten a revival of sorts in a very positive way. I would love to hear your thoughts about Ryan Gosling as an actor, because you've probably, have you seen his a few of his filmography?
Oh, for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
No, I've seen the big ones.
The
I'm
Notebook.
Knuff. Oh. I gotta watch that one.
It's
Well,
on
yeah,
there.
like, Barbie, I'm
Yeah.
Knuff. I've seen La La Land.
Yeah.
Seen
Have you
I
seen
still
The
need
Place Beyond the
to
Pines?
No, I need to see
Okay.
those. I need to see his more like niche stuff,
Well, yeah, I'd be curious, like, when you watch something like Lars and the Real World or Half Nelson,
Like what Blue Valentine or
Blue
whatever.
Valentine with Dennis Cena France is incredible. He's Derek Cena France. He's a little bit more contemporary Ryan Gosling, so you haven't seen some of his like smaller works per se. So I guess, have you seen The Nice Guys?
No, I did
Okay.
see Fall Guy or
The
the
Fall
Fall
Guy.
Guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Different type of Ryan Gosling performances in both.
For sure.
But yeah, I guess similar name. But yeah, Ryan Gosling to you, he's a movie star, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Classic sense of the word, or just more of like a contemporary type of movie star?
I mean, he's definitely like he's like the big Ryan, There's like
Yeah.
Ryan Gosling and Ryan Reynolds, and like you're one of them. You're either team Ryan or team Ryan,
Let me expand. Where are you on the Chris's? There's like a Chris Pine, there's a Chris Evans, and then there's like a Chris Hemsworth, like, or and also like who's
Chris
Rocket Raccoon?
Pratt.
Chris
Yeah,
Pratt,
let's
yeah.
not. Listen, after Garfield, like it just kind of went downhill from there.
Yeah, okay. I mean, he's getting money. He's got more money than I'm ever gonna have, so good on him. But yeah, anything else about Project Hail Mary? You want to go into like some deeper stuff, or
I will say that, I mean, I guess it's kind of a segue here, but say that Daniel Pemberton is having his moment.
Interesting. Okay.
So yeah, I know a lot of people like the score on Project Hail Mary.
Yeah.
And Daniel Pemberton's been popping off this year. I mean, 'cause he also did the drama as well
Yeah. What
with
an incredible segue that you've just
yeah.
made here. The other movie that we're talking about here, as you've seen in the title, is The Drama. This is a film that came out this past year, that stars Zendaya and Robert Pattinson. It's about this couple that is getting engaged, and they during a drunken evening, they have a conversation with a couple of friends, and some things are revealed. Riesling, what did you think of the drama?
I also really like the drama. Yeah. Gosh, I'll say, going on from my Daniel Pemberton point, it was very suspenseful, very, very antagonizing with his three flute score.
Ooh.
Yeah, only three flutes were used in the making of the score of the drama. And it was, yeah, I will say, okay, because I like kind of watched it a little late,
Okay.
but I made sure not to look at any of the spoilers, right? And I feel like the
Yeah.
trailer beforehand did a pretty good job of like, I don't know, like revealing what would be, but also like what isn't said. So I went into it kind of blind, and I really liked it, and I felt like the film did a very good job of keeping that tension going throughout. It was pretty short, or relative to like today's time standards. Like it was less than 2 hours, so I think the tension throughout those 1 hour and 45 minutes was very well thought out. And yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly, I really enjoyed it as well, and we talked about it at great length in one of our previous episodes. One of my favorite things about it is how it's not shy about what it's talking about, and we'll get into some spoilers here in a second, but it's not shy about what it's talking about, and it's very fascinating about like the virtue signaling that might happen when somebody else hears something and kind of sort of steps up in that front, even though arguably what that person said is like even worse than what Zendaya said. And I'm just like, yeah, this is just because of the, I guess, the like what's the word I'm looking for here, where the connotation that you'd have with what Zendaya says is much more of like an 11 out of 10 versus like a 10 out of, or versus like maybe like a 9 out of 10 for what like Alana Haim's character says. But yeah, curious your thoughts on I guess how dark it did get, and then I'd love to kind of just go into some spoilers there.
Yeah, it definitely took a really dark turn, especially when
Is that
there
was something that you
was
expected?
definitely not.
Okay.
But yeah, like with the whole flashback sequence and all of that, like where you see I guess like younger Zendaya's character and like everything that she's going through. And yeah, I just feel like it was kind of a blur between reality and like someone's own subconscious. And I guess almost two different timelines of what makes a person. And the movie was able to kind of meld that into one in a way. And it's a very interesting topic, I'd say, especially like in this modern day where gun violence is like one of the top acts or like causes of death among young people. And
Yeah, let's get into some full-on spoilers here. So, again, we talked about it before previously, but Zendaya's character, like, go ahead and set it up, Riesling.
yeah, so Zendaya's character, on a drunken night, like a week before her and Robert Pattinson's wedding, she reveals that she had a desire to shoot up her school, like when she was 14 or something. And then that causes like a fallout between her friend, whose like cousin was a victim of a school shooting, and it causes Robert Pattinson to kind of, I don't know, doubt Zendaya's character as a whole, and like whether this is like truly someone that like he loves or should love.
Or even that he knows, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. Yes.
Like, is this even the same person that he fell in love with, like when he awkwardly had the opening coffee,
Oh,
sequence with
yeah.
her, which was hilarious. This movie is also very darkly comedic.
Yes, 100%.
And so through that drunken night there, and again, Alana Haim, her character reveals that she took a mentally challenged boy into the woods, into like an RV, locked him in a room, like one of the storage rooms in that RV, and then just like ran away because she got scared. And they found him like a day later, kind of thing. Like the police found him like a day later. And then Zendaya's character reveals that she had plans for a school shooting and she did not go through with it. And then Alana Haim kind of like snaps at her and be like, I can't believe that you're a terrible person, kind of thing. But you grew up in an era where, sadly, school shootings have become quite normal, and there is a school shooting like quite often in the United States, versus like when I was growing up, like the largest one was Columbine, and that was like in 1997 or something like that. So, before that, we kind of didn't really think about these things. And I'm curious, like, how that would that hit your ears, just somebody who has grown up with these things, and presumably like been maybe relatively even close to some of these things.
I'd say that I feel like overall, like our generation as a whole has become a little desensitized to gun violence. I mean, like online, you'll see like people just like filming evacuations and stuff because it's so desensitized. And I don't know. I feel like, yeah, you were kind of talking about the idea of intent versus action, right? Through these like two characters, I guess, like quote unquote, like worst things they've ever done, right? And I don't know, I feel like the movie definitely portrays Zendaya's character in a more positive light, right? Like her character arc, she goes through like wanting to commit this act of violence as an angsty teenager who really like doesn't have, or like I guess like even Robert Pattinson's character was trying to like justify why she would act this way, right? And he's kind of like I don't know, extrapolating or like exaggerating things that she's like told him, like, oh, her best friend died or whatever, right? And like trying to justify these, but really
But it's
she didn't
also
have a full like justification per se.
And at times, like,
yeah.
Robert Pattinson's character is, like, outwardly, like, vehemently defending Zendaya. Like, she never went through with it, you know what I mean? Like, so it's very, like, push and pull for Robert Pattinson's character of Charlie. But the Zendaya character, you're hinting on something that the movie takes great care in sort of setting up, which is Zendaya is, you know, she's, for better or worse, like, the term would be, like, army brat, you know, where she, her father's in the military, and they moved around a lot, and so she just didn't have a lot of friends, and she has to change school so often, and she becomes kind of like this she kind of like withdraws into the internet. And I don't know how it is was for you, like, growing up, just, you know, you're pretty social, but the internet can be like a dangerous place, and so the movie, it's not out of the blue, with Zendaya's character, kind of where she comes from and sort of like how she came about this. And then I think to your point too, like, the movie takes some good care in showing her character growth, right? Like, she's always on the page of let's start over, like, in a very positive way. You know, she asked Robert Pattinson this, like, a few times in the movie, actually. You know, they're having an argument over the coffee mug or something like that, and then she's like, let's just start over. And then the ending is just, like, incredible. But yeah, curious, like, internet culture and your take on that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I think, I don't know, I'd be supposed to say that I feel like there is definitely a romanticization of these darker things. Like, I mean, there are those platforms like 4chan or, I don't know, the darker corners of Reddit and all of these things that kind of romanticize violence or romanticize, I don't know, gore or any of those type of things. And it's created this, and also, I guess, this internet culture of like trying to find or fall into your niche, right? And so for those still trying to find out, I don't know, like I guess which community they can belong into, it's really easy to fall into these type of things and feel the need to project or romanticize these ideals. Like I even like mental health or mental illness and like depression, suicidal thoughts, those are all romanticized in a way. Of like, I don't know, falling into different aesthetics, like, oh, I don't know, sad girl aesthetic or Lana Del
Interesting.
Rey, like, yeah, that type of
Yeah.
aesthetic. And especially for young people on the internet, I feel like it's really easy to be influenced. And so Zendaya's character kind of I don't know, I feel like it's definitely a manifestation of growing up in a digital age, for sure.
Is that something that you grew up into, you'd say? Like, digital age for sure. Like, just you had an iPad in front of you since you were young.
Yeah, for sure, I'd say.
Yeah. What were some of the protections that your parents put on you, though? Just like, hey, don't go down these websites, or you're only limited to, like, screen time for an hour a day.
Well, I mean, I wasn't allowed my iPad, you know, like I was only allowed on my iPad for like an hour a day.
Got it. Yeah. So there's, like, parental supervision there
Yeah, for
in that
sure.
front. Yeah. But now you're just, like, free reign on your iPhone all the
That's one way to put it.
time. Anything else about the drama that you want to chat about?
No, I think we covered most of it.
I do want to point out that the ending is, it's quite powerful, like, in sort of what it's doing. I think Robert Pattinson and Zendaya are both giving incredible performances in that last, like, 4 or 5 minutes of this movie. People in my theater were sobbing when the lights came up. It's very, like, the tone shift and the tone change of things was incredible. Like, it just was a pretty cool experience. You saw this in theaters too, yeah? Was there anything else that you want to chat about? Anything that you've seen that maybe hasn't hit the theaters yet?
I was lucky enough to get to be able to go to a pre-screening of Boots Riley's I Love Boosters. And I will say it's his second film, right? 'Cause his debut was Sorry to Bother You, 2018.
Yeah, he's been around for a while, like, doing, like, TV and all this other, but
Yeah, and
yeah,
like,
feature film,
yeah.
it would be Sorry to Bother You, but yeah, he's been doing, like, music videos and commercials and, again, television for a whole bunch of other stuff too.
Yeah, and while I'll say that, like, Sorry to Bother You was definitely like weird, especially like with that middle twist involving the horses. Isle of Boosters was another level of weird.
Really? Okay.
It was, yeah. I mean, he's still using like some claymation stuff, which is cool to see, like a mix of mediums and all that.
I've seen some of that in the trailer. I'm very curious to check it out.
But gosh, it was weird. But
In a
I'm
very
also
like likable
sure.
way? Or
I'm
more
still trying
like,
to
wow,
figure
this
that
is
out.
this is like giving me nightmares.
It's definitely memorable, but I will say that the costumes and like set design, that must have been so fun to design
Oh,
or
cool. Okay,
just to be like a part of. Yeah, because those costumes are phenomenal.
Any standout
But
performances
yeah.
to you?
I mean, Kiki Palmer
Kiki
was
Palmer.
she was pretty good. She's pretty good. Star of the show.
Did you watch Kiki Palmer's comedy from last year, where she is in Los Angeles and she's got to like pay rent, and her roommate is SZA?
No, I have not seen that.
It's a really funny movie. I think you should check it out. One of them days. So it's a little bit weird, not really in your realm there, but I'm glad that you checked it out. There's also something very cool which you kind of showed me, which is Boots Riley was on a road show with I Love Boosters, going around different cities, kind of like doing some really fun stage stuff where he pretends like he's floating or something like that and taking photos. You technically are in a photo of his, but he's but what what's the hold up there?
Yeah, he covered me with his big ass hat. He was wearing like a 2 foot tall, like teal hat, and I was behind that.
So you could have been in a published photo. His hat got in the way.
But yeah, it was definitely very interesting to hear kind of his I guess like creative process and like
How did
how he
that
kind of
go?
approaches his work. So, yeah, I mean, it was nice. He answered questions from the audience. Yeah.
Did you talk about sort of the way that he likes to direct actors and or the process in which he was trying to get this distributed, or what did he mostly
Oh,
chat
yeah, for
about?
sure. He was talking about, I guess like getting all these big names to like work on his project, right? He said he directly just DM'd Kiki Palmer
Oh, really?
and had her read the script. Yeah. And she
That's
was
how
like,
we
yeah,
got some
I'm
directors on
down.
the show in the past and some writers on the show in the past. We're just
Yeah. So, I
DMing them
mean,
on
just the
Twitter.
power of a cold call.
I guess. I'm glad that you got exposed to like the way that, Boots Riley is a very talented filmmaker and he's a very like interesting creative guy, and he certainly does things in a different way. Not that he's like trying to buck the system necessarily, he still gets releases from these larger studios. But yeah, it's very fascinating to see like folks like him versus like, we just talked about Project Hail Mary, which like has Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who are notable Hollywood names now. But not that Boots Riley is not, but just more that there certainly is a little bit more cachet. It's like, yeah, we want to get Phil Miller, Chris Lord movie. And people are like, yeah, sure, here you go. Versus like Boots Riley being like, I want to make a new movie. Like, tell me the premise first, kind of thing, So,
Yeah.
is that something that you're interested in, by the way? Are you like interested in making movies?
Maybe,
Okay.
maybe.
Well, you've got a lot of power in your phone, so feel free to
For
just start
sure.
shooting on
Shooting
the
DMs.
DMs, but also just like interesting footage whenever you want to take out your phone and just like record, make your sister say something hilarious or something like that.
For sure.
Rizing, I want to transition into sort of like, I guess this next topic here. You are going to university in the great state of New York. And I wanted to ask you, I put together some films here, but I want to ask you about like New York in movies and New York films. New York is a very magical place. Like, I don't know if you saw Past Lives. Past Lives takes
Oh
place
yeah. Celine
in
Song loves New York
loves New
with
York.
yeah, Materialist too.
Materialist, yeah. So again, New York as like sort of like a character in a movie can loom quite large. And I'm curious like if you've seen any of these like New York films and sort of your take on New York in itself.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, can't really mention New York without Spider-Man, right?
You
New
do
York.
love that movie. Like you
I do
yeah.
love
And you're
Across the
talking yeah, the
Spider-Verse.
animated The new Sony animated ones, yeah. Have you seen the Tobey Maguire ones and the Andrew Garfield ones?
Yeah, I've seen the first Tobey Maguire, the first Andrew Garfield one,
Okay.
and more or less all the Tom Holland ones.
Yeah. It,
Yeah.
who's your Spider-Man?
I mean, I'd say my generation Spider-Man is Tom Holland, but
Yeah.
Andrew Garfield has a special place in my heart.
Okay. For his other works or just as that Peter Parker?
As that Peter Parker.
Oh, really? Okay. Did you haven't seen
Yeah.
Spider-Man 2 yet with Tobey Maguire?
No, I
One
haven't.
of the greater comic book movies ever made, man. Check it out when you have some
I'll check it out,
check it out
yeah.
when you have some time. But yeah, New York movies you were mentioning Across the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, I mean, definitely New York as a character is just all those buildings,
Yeah.
right? That they're swinging around from. Yeah, like the Central Bank building, all the bridges, all the subways. I mean, it's definitely a character for sure.
Yeah.
And I think just like the general location of New York City, right? And kind of what it means. The Safdie brothers also love New
Yeah.
York, right? With Uncut Gems and more recently Marty Supreme, right?
Right.
Yeah, I feel like the decision to shoot in New York City or like have a setting in New York City definitely, I think, speaks to the characters or the overall plot, or I don't know, just like the overall vibes, you
Yeah.
know?
It's
Yeah.
not the only reason you chose to go to school in New York, right?
Oh,
Just like,
gosh,
oh,
wait,
they
how'd
make
you
movies in New
know?
York. Like, I should go there. I want to pull a Greta Gerwig and just go to New York and feel like I'm one with the artists, and so I can become an artist myself.
I mean, partially the reason. The other part's
Okay.
the bagels, of course.
The bagels are delicious. The pizza is great.
Yeah.
They say it's the water, and New York drinking water is pretty good. But have you seen other New York films that sort of invoke the sense of New York to you?
I think New York's also very romanticized through rom-coms, right? Like Nora Ephron loves New York.
Yeah.
Contrary to the title, Sleepless in Seattle is pretty New York central.
I mean, there's a character there, yeah.
Yeah, there's also, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, When Harry Met Sally,
Yeah.
all the good stuff.
Yeah, I've got a list here. I'm gonna rattle some names off here, but Elf. You've certainly seen Elf, I'm sure.
I have.
Yeah. And then Miracle on 34th Street, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. Arguably the better film of the Home Alones, one and
Oh, I
two.
agree, 100%.
I can't believe you. Okay. Thanks for ruining my life. Home Alone 1 classic. But I could see the pacing in Home Alone 2.
No, Home Alone 1 is the classic.
There you go. Thank
Yeah.
you. I knew
Elf
we were.
though, I'm kind of an Elf hater, no offense.
Really? Okay. Yeah. I certainly know that there is like that ilk. What's wrong with Elf for you?
Buddy.
His annoyance level, or is it just that he's
I
like in
mean,
the bathroom with, that woman as they sing a song?
the entire film is just rage bait.
Is this how your generation feels about Elf?
No, I'm like one of the very few. One of
Oh,
my
got
friends
it.
is an adamant elf lover.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly has its charm. I can certainly see where some people might not like it.
But like, I watch Christmas movies to feel happy.
He makes a brother and he, gets good with James Gunn at the end.
Sure.
Christmas cheer, gotta sing for all to hear. You've got Mail, Breakfast at Tiffany's, classic. When Harry Met Sally, The Devils Are Prada, The Devil Wears Prada. Did you see that one?
I haven't seen one and two,
Okay,
so I'm a little
I'd be
behind.
no, all good. I'm curious because they are stylistically kind of like the same, but also different because the first one was made in 2006, and so the way that Anne Hathaway dresses with like riding boots and hats is very 2006. And I'd be curious, like
Yes.
from your fresh eyes, just like. I can't believe that you guys went out in public like this or something.
Yeah, what
In the
else is new?
Heights, which is a musical that got adapted, which I was okay with. I think that whenever you do a musical adaptation to the screen, you could do more things that you cannot do on the stage. And while they did employ some of it, I think that there was like some grander things that maybe you could do.
Sure, yeah. What else? Wolf of Wall Street, American Psycho, Anora, 1001.
Did you watch 1001?
No, I didn't.
Okay, yeah, that's a really good movie. I really enjoyed it from a few years ago. But yeah, it's like a ton of great movies here. You're going to a great city, and one that I think is rife with a lot of artistic talent, whether it be the comedy scene, Saturday Night Live is shot there, as well as like a ton of comedy rooms are there, and then movies, TV, like everyone just knows New York. So, Rizing, this has been very nice to chat with you about some of these things here. I want to get into some listener questions. Feel free to chime in if you have thoughts on them. We usually do this in a segment we call feedback, but I just asked for like some mail this past week. The first one here is from Chris Cleveland, who writes, "Hey Abe, how do you guys cope with rowdy cinema viewings, and is it an American thing? I remember going to see Lord of the Rings in DC years ago, and people were up applauding all the time. Very strange behavior. Not what we do in the UK."
Oh
Chris,
my gosh.
this is a very good question. Freezing, hit it.
Can I talk about this? Oh my
Please.
gosh. Can I? So, you know how the Minecraft movie came out? Like, I don't know, was it like a year ago, maybe?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And everyone was shouting chicken jockey and throwing popcorn everywhere.
Was that
And like,
decided upon beforehand?
no, I don't know. And like,
Because
sneaking live chickens into the theater.
what?
Yeah,
I
it
don't
was
remember that
just like,
part.
I don't know. I feel like internet trends just fuel movie rowdiness, and it's very, very annoying. And even more recently, when I went to go see gosh, I went to go see something, I forgot what,
Yeah.
but there was this couple next to me and they would not shut up, and it was so annoying.
Was it a serious movie?
Oh, okay, it was one battle after another.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't want people to talk throughout the movie either.
Yeah, and they were just like yapping the whole time. And yeah, movie theater rowdiness has gotten out of control. And I think, I don't know.
Do you blame your generation?
100%. I
Oh
also
wow,
blame
okay.
COVID. Yeah, because there's no movie etiquette anymore. Yeah, like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I have been in a couple of rowdy screenings. I generally am probably okay with some rowdiness, and I say okay mostly because like if it's like a horror movie, as I talked about when we talked about weapons on the show, people were hooting and hollering and having a really good time and talking back to the screen and being like, "Oh fuck no," and shit like that. And it was really fun. It was really great. So, some rowdiness can kind of apply. But as I've talked to with Aaron about, and I've mentioned on the show many times, I went to go see the space movie with Sandra Bullock, which I can't remember right now off the top of my head. Sandra Bullock, I have to look it up. Gravity. I want to go see Gravity in 2013. And there's like a very quiet moment toward the end of, in the third act of this movie, where somebody comes back to her, and some asshole right behind me is like, "This has to be a dream." I'm like, what the fuck else could it be, man? Like, this is clearly not real right now. Like, shut the fuck up. And he just happened to be right behind me. It really ruined like that experience for me. Another time is I went to go see Star Wars: The Last Jedi with our family up in Seattle. And this was like a few weeks after like the opening. And so some jagoff, teenage kid, was he made like a joke when Laura Dern's character goes into lightspeed, and it just like really ruins it because it's a very quiet moment. It's kind of like a somber moment, and some jagoff made that comment there. I will say, just to answer Chris's question about how do you cope with the rowdy cinema viewings, I think that because of COVID, we started in the US started implementing assigned seats. And so I do have a lot of the apps on my phone, and I will just check out which theaters, which rooms, and which times have the fewest amount of people so that I can kind of watch it like almost in my own kind of space. And so that is, a side effect of COVID that has not left, which I think is a good thing, in that you can reserve seats ahead of time. I don't even know. Were you even like around those times where seats were You had to put a coat on some seats and be like, oh, sorry, these three are taken.
No.
Yeah.
There's
So
some archaic techniques.
it was the thing to do. You'd show up like an hour before the screening, you'd kind of get in there and like you reserve some seats for you and your friends. And then they'd just show up. It was what we did. We were just people on a whim back in the day, back in the 90s. But as far as like the Lord of the Rings goes, I think as the movies progressed, and this is my remembrance of it at least, as the movies progressed, they became increasingly much more crowd reaction heavy, almost like very similar to like how the MCU stuff happened, in either in Infinity War or in Endgame. People just like really got a little more rowdy in their seats. Do I like it? Not necessarily, but also I can understand it, especially if you've been with this character for like 12 years kind of thing. But for something like what you mentioned in Minecraft movie, I did not know any of this stuff was going to happen. Like I went there like opening night, like it was a Thursday night. That's why I asked you, like, did they talk about this beforehand? Because that happened to me during the Chicken Jack scene, and it was hilarious, but also like really unexpected. And I did not expect the popcorn to be, jumping out of seats. Like I see now why people, I was wondering why people were putting their hoods on, like for their hoodies. And I had a hoodie on too. I certainly could have prepared for this, but did not expect it. So as far as it being an American thing, perhaps, but also I think it could just be because people are really excited for characters that they have seen, and or I think the drum of internet culture, and saying like just the way that you were alive during the Gentle Minions period, where people would just like wear suits and go to
Oh,
the Gentle
yes. I
Minions.
mean, I think movies as or movie going as a general because or in general, because I don't know, people, or at least in my generation, I feel like people don't go as often. Like, movie going becomes this kind of like cultural event. Like, coming up, we're gonna have Dunes Day, Dune Part 3
Yes.
and Doomsday
Yeah.
on the same
Avengers.
opening weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's gonna be like another big cultural event where I think you should probably prep for some movie rowdiness.
I'd be curious how that goes, because I don't think anyone's dressing up as Robert J. Oppenheimer during Barbenheimer. But
No, they
also,
were.
were they wearing like
Yes.
fedoras
Yeah,
and
they'd
smoking
swish.
jackets?
Or it'd be like a pink fedora,
A pink fedora. Okay, this makes a lot of sense. I'd be curious like how that happens in December when we're gonna arrive at there. I hope that it's calm. I don't even have tickets for Dune because it got sold out like a year ago. And
It's
so it,
ridiculous.
I what am I gonna do? Like, how am I supposed to see this? It's difficult. All right, next question here. David Maloof asks, guys, we often question why he writes question marks after his guys there phrasing, because it could be read as like guys? Okay, so my question is this. I'm thinking of really great ideas for alternate movie realities, and one of them might be called Paul's. In this multiverse serial comedy, Paul W.S. Anderson and Paul Thomas Anderson switch places and end up directing each other's films while their individual directors, with their individual directors' artistic vision, aesthetic, and overall sensibility. It might be interesting and even hilarious to see Paul W.S. Anderson's take on Boogie Nights, The Master, Magnolia, There Will Be Blood, and even One Battle After Another. Likewise, with PTA directing Mortal Kombat 1995, Event Horizon, and Resident Evil movies, and Alien vs. Predator. Of course, it'd be a whole lot more fleshing out, but what the hell? What do you guys think of this concept, and what would be some of your own ideas for these kinds of movies? Sorry again for being extremely long-winded, and thanks for everything that you do. Breezy, do you have any answer to this?
I'm not a big Paul W.S. Anderson viewer, so I'll leave it to you.
Paul W.S. Anderson certainly has a style of his that I think is, for better or worse, like entertaining, even if it's like, kind of empty calories sometimes. But also, it actually can be when you watch like some of the movies that he has made versus some people's other takes, like the Resident Evil type of films. You're like, Paul W.S. Anderson, at least he had like sort of like an idea or a vision that he held on to that he wanted to put onto the screen, which is commendable, I would say. So if you were to switch these two out, I think it'd be fascinating, like just the way that Paul Thomas Anderson kind of makes movies, and the tone that he would give to Resident Evil or something like Soldier, or even Event Horizon. I mean, I'm sure that they'd get the same points across. I don't know if it'd be something that I would want to see all the time. Like I like this idea of director swap for some movies. We might have even had segments like this in the show in the past, but I Paul W.S. Anderson directing Magnolia to me would be like, I'd be curious what that movie is. More so curious like what a Boogie Nights would be. Like Paul Thomas Anderson. Yeah, Paul Thomas Anderson made that at like 26. He made Boogie Nights at 26, and it's like I'd be curious like what 26-year-old Paul Davis and W.S. Anderson would do with that movie. Do I like this idea, David? It's an interesting thought exercise. I would hope that it doesn't come to fruition, because I think that, from what I know about Paul Thomas Anderson, the way that he deals with themes in his movies and exploring those themes. Whether it be like found family and or father figures and everything else, like I'd be curious how that actually fits into the Resident Evil franchise, I guess. But David, really good question. I'd be curious if somebody actually has probably created something on YouTube or something like that for it, but no thanks.
But the real question is, do you think one battle after another directed by Paul W.S. Anderson would still win the
Probably not.
Oscars?
But we'll never know. So alternate tell or alternate reality timeline has to happen. We have got to have a weird looper situation here. And the last question here is from other co-host Aaron Newworth, who is currently on vacation in Japan. He writes, "Hey there, guys and guests, longtime listener, first time caller, big fan of Abe, especially. Question: Let's say that we've staged a triathlon, running, swimming, and bicycle." Between Tom Hanks as Forrest Gump, Ethan Hawke as Vincent from Gattaca, and Tom Cruise as John Anderton in Minority Report, Matt Damon as Jason Bourne, and Will Smith as Mike Lowry in Bad Boys. Who's winning? Bonus, let's say there's a fourth stage where upon completing the initial triathlon, they would now have to fight to the death. Who's coming out on top? Okay, so this is a team question. So we got Tom Hanks. Forrest Gump, he's really good at running. He runs across the United States, right? Ethan Hawke, Vincent from Gattaca, swims. His brother challenges him to swim to the island. He's always just like, you know how I won? Because I never left anything for the swim back. So he's just a swim head. Let's see here. Tom Cruise, John Anderton, Minority Report. I mean, Tom Cruise is always running and everything. I don't know if your generation has picked up on that too recently.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, the Tom Cruise hands. Yeah,
Tom
the
Cruise
knife
hands, like
hands.
they're straight hands, and he's just like running away there. Okay, so let's see here. Let's see. Versus Matt Damon, Will Smith, John Anderton. Okay, wait a minute. How many people are here, or is he asking all of them? Let's
Yeah,
say
they
we stage
all have to
a
do a
triathlon.
triathlon.
Got it. Okay, who's winning? Okay, let's go through the rest of these here real quick. John Anderton, okay, he's really good at running, but also like I don't know if he's great at swimming. He gets in the pool. Minority Report doesn't really gets a struggle. It's like a 3 foot pool. Matt Damon, Jason Bourne, he seems like he's really good at everything, especially jumping through windows and jumping across buildings. Will Smith is Mike Lowry. Okay, Mike Lowry and Bad Boys. I mean, like what can't Mike Lowry do, right? Saving all of his buddies, jumping into traffic, wearing like heavy Nikes and Reeboks, so got a really cool car. Let's see. I feel like mine would come down to, okay, we're gonna eliminate some people here. I think Mike Lowry is eliminated. I think that for no other reason than I don't know where Mike Lowry is on like the cycling stuff. He's very physically fit. He can certainly run. I'm pretty sure he can swim. He lives in Miami. So I'm gonna that and Vincent from Gattaca. So Ethan Hawke, have you seen Gattaca?
No.
Gattaca is really good. It's like this movie from 1997 where you can choose what your baby genetically will be like. You can have them free from illnesses and or a gold medal type of athlete kind of thing. And Ethan Hawke's character is born normal. where his brother has been genetically altered. And so because he's been born normal, he's always striving to one, he is a very smart guy. He's just like physically, limited at some points, physically limited, being like he's got to wear glasses because everyone else has perfect vision kind of thing. So I'm going to also eliminate Ethan Hawke because, yes, he's good at swimming, but we saw in one part where he's running on the treadmill and he gets super winded when the guy goes away. He's like, he just can't keep up with that heart rate. So Ethan Hawke is eliminated. Tom Cruise, I know he's good at running. Is he good at biking or swimming? That part I don't know. He's also, Mission Impossible-ing at things. He's been climbing the towers in those movies. I'm gonna eliminate Tom Cruise too. Matt Damon. It's now between like Matt Damon and Tom Cruise or Tom Hanks. Matt Damon. He's got a lot of moves. He can certainly kill people. He can identify threats a mile away. He's capable with computers. So I'm gonna have to limit. I think it's Tom Hanks in Forrest Gump. We know that he can run, and it feels as though he's like once he's locked into something, he gets really good at it. Like when he plays ping pong, he just becomes a national champion. Represents the United States in ping pong.
Marty Supreme.
I mean, he'd beat the pants off of Marty and Marty Supreme. So, I think the answer here is Tom Hanks because or Forrest Gump. Because Forrest Gump would just lock in and just be like, "You told me to go run, and so I did. You told me to go swim, and so I did. You told me to bike, so I did." And there he is, just champion. So, if there's a fourth stage and they've got to fight to the death, I mean, Tom Cruise, he's a secret agent spy. Matt Damon, I think it'd be Matt Damon. It'd be between Matt Damon and Mike Lowry coming up. Just for the title there, I'd probably give the edge to Matt Damon just because he's on chems and he can turn superhuman to some degree. But maybe he'll get a headache right as Mike Lowry is going to punch him in the face. So there you go. These are really good questions. Thank you for that, Aaron. Hopefully your vacation is going well. Reasoning, we did it. We've successfully talked about your generation's view on the movies. Project Hail Mary, the drama, a little bit of not sorry to bother you, but I
I
love
love
boosters.
boosters, yeah.
Yeah, and some New York films. I hope that your movie going life continues in terms of
Yes,
like just
this is a great year for movie releases.
there you go. Yeah, and going to college is one of those things where people are just like, "Have you seen this?" And they'll be like, "Let's go watch it right now." It's like, all right, cool guy. Like, yes, I have seen Pulp Fiction 47 times. So I'm curious, like, what that would look like for you. Like, what movies are people going to be introducing to you, and what movies are you going to be introducing to them? Because you'd be like, have you guys checked out, Days of Heaven? They'd be like, no, never even heard of that movie. Who's Terrence Malick? But yeah, I have enjoyed this conversation with you. Is there anything that you want to plug or anything that you want to shout out?
Nope.
Perfect. With that, thank you very much for listening, listeners. Thank you very much for everybody who wrote in. We'll be back next week with a full episode, as well as Aaron's thoughts on Obsession, among some other things there. Also, special shout out, thank you for to Sandy to giving us that quick snippet about the Sheep Detectives. I'm
Oh my
glad
God, I
that.
want to watch that.
I mean, from her review, it sounds like you should go see it immediately. And I think like everyone else has also said that it's been fantastic. But yeah, we'll be back next week. Until then, so long and goodbye. Unless I stuck by ya, you're the sunflower. You're the sunflower. Every time I'm leaving.